I've been a lute player and a continuo accompanist for some 15 or so years before starting this project. And during that time, I spent quite a lot of time developing different techniques of improvisation to accompany mainly Italian and French music. And it's always occurred to me that people have spent a lot more time and, dare I say it, money in investing in the Italian and French repertoires to bring them to life off the page. And I think it's partly a symptom of our very logocentric culture that often English music seemed to be deemed to be ideally played when it was played straight. So when you can hear the words properly and not messed about with, in the way that people have often messed about with Italian and French continuo scorings or ornamentation or other modes of delivery. And this seems to me to have limited the opportunities to represent the dramatic range of well-known composers like John Dowland and Henry Purcell, but it's also more seriously dented the reputation of their lesser colleagues, most often those who are working in a theatrical or a mask context where collaboration has been the creative norm. And the musical notation for these sort of productions was sketched out first for professional hands to interpret, and only later then served up in a different printed form to a book-buying public. The minimal nature of the professional scores, which are often just a tune and a bass line, has encouraged a view of English musicians as technically rather inferior to their foreign competitors. Two of the most often repeated musicological questions about early 17th century English music are, where has the music gone? And why didn't the English invent opera? So that's the starting point for today, the foundations of English opera. The answer to the first question, where has the music gone, seemingly lay in a loss of compositional nerve after the Elizabethan Golden Age. And the Elizabethan Golden Age was considered to be a time where poetry and music were equal partners in the creative project, neither one overruling or obscuring the other. And it seemed then that the musicians all just laid down and let the poets walk all over them afterwards, writing music that would be, as famous poet Edmund Waller described it, a window on the text. So something that you see through, but you don't really spend much time looking at. And the answer to the second question was even more damning. England lacked the imagination and the musical skill to produce opera of the first rank. Edward Dent, who wrote what is still today the only full-length book on the subject, entitled Foundations of English Opera, wrote at the very end, the last sentence ringing in your ears, "We must admit that they are dead." That's the operas, not the people. "But there is at least one place where the dead are of definite use to us, the School of Anatomy." And another quote, which will particularly be a favourite of James, I'm sure. "Music for the Italian is an exaggeration of personality. For the Englishman, it's annihilation." So there we have it. Post-colonial Englishman with his stiff upper lip, not really interpreting the music in too extreme a way. And so to practical ways of addressing these questions, and that's what my project has been about so far. I took a closer look, especially at manuscript sources of the generation of lute song composers, and then with the styles of writing and the style of performance of music for the Jacobean and the Caroline Masque. And this set the scene for a re-examination of the music of mid-century composers, such as Henry and William Laws. It's been very crucial to persuade some of the most distinguished singers and players that I know to apply these types of improvisation to rarely heard repertoire in the first place, and only then to apply it to the music we all know so well in these circles, the music of Henry Purcell. So once you've been corrupted, if you like, by an unknown approach, then we've been able to approach things that we thought we knew in the first place. Lo and behold, when I was involved in a production of Dido and Aeneas, this great opera was not a technical leap forward, nor striking out into any unknown territory, but seemed a logical way of deploying skills that had been honed for the previous 60 years. Examining manuscripts that contain lute songs revealed a strong connection with the theatre. While books were published for gentlemen and lady amateurs to perform at home, theatre companies compiled the best bits to suit the boy actors who were highly trained in music, thanks to the choir schools from which the theatre companies recruited. So these were budding professional singers in an age where the untrained natural voice has been often deemed to be a performance ideal. I remember somebody called Sting mentioning that in a recording of John Dowland. What these boys did with the music is quite revealing. Sources reveal large doses of ornamentation, accompaniments wantonly rewritten to suit the size and acoustics of a particular venue, and in general the kind of freedom that has often been associated with poor taste in our times. I'm very grateful to James Gilchrist here.
Mentioning poor taste.
I was going to put it slightly differently. Himself a marvellous improviser of unforeseen additions, was how I phrased it, for accompanying me around the place to a conference at the Birmingham Shakespeare Institute and then to the Yale Centre of British Art and in many different festival and concert hall venues around. So we're going to start with the example we took to the Shakespeareans, Full Fathom Five. It's very well known as a text, song from Shakespeare's Tempest. I thought we should try this as a classic example of the kind of thinking that is often cited. When the text is good, don't mess about with it. You can't get much better than Shakespeare. So let's pretend that James has read Critic A. We'll call her Mary Chan, but she could be called Andrew Sable or a number of other literary and musicological critics, some of whom you'll find cited by me in a forthcoming article in Early Music in May. So Group Critic A analysed the text, Shakespeare's text, and then applaud the setting for its simplicity. So here it is. It's by Robert Johnson, by the way.
Full fathom five thy father lies, of his bones a coral made, those are pearls that were his eyes, nothing of him that doth fade, but doth suffer the sea change into something rich and strange. Sea nymphs are ring his knell. Hark, I hear them. Hark, I hear them. Ding, dong, bell. Ding, dong, ding, dong, bell.
Very lovely and very beautiful. Had James read Critic B, the group of critics that actually say you can't really tell anything about that setting from what's on the page, because there could have been somebody singing, as they called it, cum voce tremula, which is something you might hear in a minute, it could have sounded very different.
Full fathom five thy father lies, of his bones a coral made, those are pearls that were his eyes, nothing of him that doth fade, but doth suffer a sea into something rich and strange. See nymphs are ringing his bell. Hark, I hear them. Hark, I hear them. Ding dong bell. Ding dong. Ding, ding, dong, bell.
Now, I wouldn't put my money on a right way of doing that song, and everyone here will possibly have violent feelings of loyalty to one method or the other. But what I've been arguing for throughout this project is if we can distance ourselves from the kind of normative position where we are searching an original and therefore a more authoritative approach. James and I have performed a number of John Dowland's later songs, which share this spotlight on the singer quality that he brought to Full Fathom Five. And this was becoming a feature of early Jacobean song, and actually, as the rather brilliant juxtaposition of these two presentations has revealed, it's not too distant from Italian practice, as you'll have heard. However, Dowland pioneered the table book format that has provided an iconic image of lute song performance that has rather stuck, where the singer and the player were gathered around a table in a domestic setting. And, of course, that was a very good way to sell books, but it doesn't necessarily mean that was the way everyone did them. Here, however, is an example of that by Alfonso Ferrabosco. Tune with the words, lute part underneath, and a bass part for a bass player to have a look over the shoulder as well. So we're going to sing that one for you. It's called Why Stays the Bridegroom to Invade Her? It's a terribly unpolitically correct text.
Why stays the bridegroom to invade her? That would be a matron maid. Good night whilst yet we may. Good night to you, a virgin, say. Tomorrow rise, the same your mother is, and use a nobler name. Speed well in hymen's war, that what you are by your
What's wonderful is when singers then apologise for improvising in a creative way. That's particularly useful in this context. At this point, I'm going to introduce a model of ornamentation that we as musicians often grow up with, which is that there is a simple version, pretty much like that, onto which later stuff is added, stuff being interpretation or addition, or different kinds of accompaniment. However, this Ferrabosco piece is one of a fair few examples I've found that challenges that view, and thus also the view of how large quantities of music in the 17th century were generated and transmitted. So without further ado, here is another version. Can you see that one? There it is. James won't mind, I hope, if I say that when we first started rehearsing this sort of thing, he, in common with one or two other singers, have said, well, I'd be quite happy to do that in Monteverdi, but we can't do that in English music. And once you imagine that the language isn't English, then a whole realm of freedom opens up to you. So this version has greater claims to be the original, as this, in fact, derives from a performance of the Haddington Mask for which this song was written. And it was sung by the sort of loud tenor that was, that's a real quote, who was famous for other Ferrabosco great moments. The printed version that we heard earlier actually came out a year later, watered down for ease of public consumption. So, tempted by all this technological wizardry, I've done a little ornamentation model for you, which will have that. So there we have simple original plus additions equals variant. That's the way I grew up making music. Number two, ornamented original minus additions equals variant simple version.
That's sort of maths even I can do.
The chronology of this is very important, as it also challenges a parallel notion about the accompaniment, which is that improvised or continuo style accompaniments came in later than the peak of Golden Age style, and indeed have been said by a number of authors to be a symptom of its decline. What we did, in fact, was to mix these two approaches with some Golden Age lute song by John Dowland. Shall we go on to the next thing? Here's a self-serving lute and voice and guitar record cover, which you can all rush out and buy, with one of James's colleagues, Mark Padmore. And responses to this have actually been very much helped by the debate that Sting created, if you like. So that was a very nice feature of the timing of this project and debate in the wider world, because it enabled us to set a kind of research-led answer to some of the performance practice questions that were raised by should a pop singer be doing this music, all that kind of thing. And the reviews have actually noted that we've been using different sources, different flexibility of ornamentation, and one even described us as open-minded, which is quite rare for classical music. However, in a mask context, like the Banqueting House, and we shouldn't forget that Dowland himself, the lute song icon, wrote masks at the end of his life, volume and richness of accompaniment would be practical necessities, as well as highly symbolic features of an art form whose main purpose was to inspire awe at the grandeur of the commissioning aristocrat or monarch. A sophisticated sounding accompaniment would have happened as a result of a consistent group of professional players who would be familiar with each other's improvising habits. We tested this out on a slightly less financially ruinous scale than most masks, with a project entitled The Mask of Moments. It was kick-started with a workshop performance here in the Turner Sims, which involved 45 people, and was a collaboration between the university here, the Royal Academy of Music, the university's new Centre for Medieval and Renaissance Culture, with professional singers and players who performed alongside the student singers, players and dancers. And this was the finale to a one-day conference entitled Beyond the Golden Age, Lutes, Lute Song, and the Lure of Opera. There should be a picture of... this, in fact, this picture was the end of a commercial tour which happened after this conference, also in the Turner Sims, and a gratifying number of people came back to hear the different version. The tour was generously funded by the Arts Council, which, in a nice link-up between our sponsors from the AHRC and the Arts Council, actually promoted the research going out to a wider public, a lot of whom were quite vocal about what they thought about the repertoire and what they thought about the way of doing it. So the whole thing was a very good learning experience. And the latest performance here, you'll see one or two people looking ever so slightly younger, I won't say, than whom, and they are the students of Cantores Michaelis, the university's choral scholars, who, as one audience member said, yes, I noticed them, they had a rather different dress sense. But gratifying, they didn't say better or worse. And in fact, they were integrated very well into the project, and I think most people agree they did magnificently. One can see why this masque repertoire obviously is very rarely done, reckoning the sheer expense. But the same sort of principles apply to the whole mid-century repertoire of song, particularly those of Henry and William Lawes. I was able to explore the relationship of Lawes with his poetic colleagues, most famously John Milton, and also how and why people like Charles Burney started an whole industry of Lawes kicking by calling the music bland, insipid, and generally inquiring whether there was any musical merit at all. Again, a look at manuscript rather than printed sources of Lawes's song revealed some clues. This time, a mid-century tradition of singing technique directly derived from French and Italian singers, where songs that to us look and maybe sound rather four square were revealed in full Italianate or French glory. Let's go to the next slide. Here we have an example of this Amaryllis by a spring on the left. Looks very simple. Amaryllis by a spring, soft and soul melting, murmuring ground. You can hear it sort of going. It's not particularly impressive. That's Henry Lawes's autograph. On the right is a manuscript version from a version in the Bodleian Library. If you look at the top part, the vocal part, again, lots of black notes in a way. We're not going to do this one because you've heard quite enough of that sort of example. But again, the sort of improvisational, very soloistic quality. And if you look at the accompaniment, it's in a lute or theorbo tablature, which I wanted just to draw your attention to. In the second bar, you'll see a very lonely rhythm sign, a dotted minim followed by a crotchet. You won't see that almost anywhere else in the song. The accompanist either was a total beginner, that's one theory that has been mooted, or couldn't play the lute very well, that's another theory, or was the singer him or herself, that's also a possibility, or one theory that I'm now working with as part of this project is that they just couldn't be bothered to write down a whole contrapuntal accompaniment. If you have a singer that could go in any given direction, there really is no point in writing much else but the harmonies that you want to play. However, the consequences of that and have again been, I think, sometimes misinterpreted in that the accompanist would just sit there quietly until the singer revealed where the next bar would be. Having played their chord, they would just kind of wait. And this surprisingly counterintuitive mode of accompanying has been the main form proposed by some of the more authoritative books on the subject, based on this sort of evidence. But when you have a voice such as James's, it's almost impossible to do nothing. But the thing is not to commit yourself into a contrapuntal way that might get derailed at any moment. At this point, I should introduce this instrument. It's a kind of spot the difference competition. The one I was playing in Erin's presentation looked very similar, but was an Italian, chitarrone, or theorbo. This machine, that one had 14 strings, all single. This one has the 27 that I heard one or two people talking about. And I swore I'd never play both in public in the same place at the same time because it's rather confusing to switch from one to another. This instrument was commissioned with the help of the university. Thank you very much. And I collaborated with lute makers Michael Lowe and Martin Haycock in amassing some iconographical evidence and some descriptions of what it might be. There's a picture of Henry Lawes playing a similar instrument. Unfortunately, his own ended up on a bonfire in Oxford when they had a clear out. But the crucial difference is the doubling of the strings. So from the bottom, it's a bit like a harpsichord. You have strings doubled at the octave. And then the top is really... And in fact, in terms of technique and sound, this isn't a theorbo at all. The English theorbo has been much talked about, very rarely played, because in fact, it is a combination of a Renaissance and a Baroque lute. And that was one of my long-standing questions that's been in my mind, is the paradigm of our profession, which has often divided lute players from theorbo players. You're either one or the other. And as a result of the work that I've been doing, it's clear that the two techniques blended very closely with each other. The next phase of my own project is where I'm looking at how this sort of instrument, would have influenced composers and in their harmonic language. I'm just going to give you a very, very brief example. A rather quixotic composer called John Wilson, very prolific songwriter, also wrote a number of triouts or preludes for this kind of instrument. I'll play a little bit of this one. Went round all the keys, ending up in E flat minor. I'm not going to play you all of that one because you have to retune almost every string, and I'm aware of the passing of time. So here is a little bit of his E flat minor test out. I would rather call them tryouts or licks for improvisation than preludes. Several more pages that eventually get you back to where we started. And yet, again, when you look at John Wilson's songs, they're all in D major or C major, and they have about three chords in them. So watch this space, because my task now is to internalise that style and then see if I can plug it back into the songs. One of the last questions that I'm going to address. We could probably get a little bit of Naked People on a Laws record sleeve as well. This time it was Robin Blaze who was the lucky singer that got to absorb that style with the helpful stimulus of a recording microphone. Now the next question, the last question that I'm going to draw your attention to as part of my project has been quite fun. It's the question of English national identity, which we touched on at the beginning. Let's have a look at the whole quote that I drew the last sentence for. To the Italian, music is a means of self-expression, or rather of self-intensification. To the Englishman, music is a thing apart, a message from another world. The Italian singer creates the music that he utters, or at least appears to create it. The English singer is a sensitive medium through which music is made audible. And then the music for the Italian is the exaggeration of personality. For the Englishman, it's annihilation. I hope we can see now that, in fact, the whole concept of Englishness is a rather complicated one, to say the least, in the 17th century as a whole, but particularly with regard to 17th century music and song. So having experimented with how a reverence for poetic text can sometimes lead to underinterpreted versions of music, I was also keen to work with instrumental colleagues, particularly to show the indebtedness of English music to French technology, French rhythmic inflection and ornamentation, and finally, and most unpopularly of all, of French personnel throughout the 17th century. The Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, with whom I've been associated as a principal lute for a decade, invited me to co-direct a production of Purcell's Dido and Aeneas at the South Bank and on tour, and then to give a talk about 17th century orchestral forces. Here, as with Dowland, we are at the centre of the composer as national treasure debate, revealing how much, for example, Purcell borrowed from Lully in iconic English pieces such as The Faery Queen, two national treasures in one, Shakespeare and Purcell, and then drawing that from that the implication that a French style of playing is appropriate for this most English of music was not always a very comfortable position. In this instance, my role as a performer researcher, if you like, was to move other people's musicological advances to the centre of the performance debate. And in the Purcell field, I'm very lucky because most of them have been, in fact, on my steering group throughout this project. But sometimes that debate has been on a parallel track to the performance track and the two never quite meeting. So that was the first thing, was to put them all together. But then we were also able to put Dido and Aeneas back, if you like, in its mask context by adding spoken text by Christopher Marlowe, his Dido, Queen of Carthage, and then drawing on the model which we'd established through the previous tour of the Mask of Moments, we'd established a group of improvising musicians based on the Jacobean and Caroline lutes and voices. So from this, we were able to generate music to go under the spoken text and make the whole thing fit back into the context of mask music from whence it came. So instead of Purcell bringing opera to a barren land, I'd like to think he actually was located alongside his colleagues on whose skills he was drawing. So, are we dissecting corpses? To save all our blushes, I've put some reviews on the last PowerPoint thing, which you're not obliged to read very closely because they're in rather small text. But I hope you get the idea, really, that this is a tribute to, in a sense, my performer colleagues. Yeah, there are a few.
I like the last one.
The last one's very good. It's very These are a tribute to my performer colleagues, and I think, hopefully, to the quality of the music that people are, I'm delighted to say, are beginning to appreciate, perhaps just a little more. Thank you very much.